Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello, welcome to another Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast with me, Richard Herring, and this week's guest is called Eddie Izzard. Can't remember much about this one. It's probably worth sticking around and listening to, I'm not sure. Exciting news, my new DVD, Lord of the Dance Settee, is finally available at gofasterstripe.com. It's got lots of extras, including Me 1 versus Me 2 audio snooker frame, big interview with me, loads of other stuff on there, lots of behind-the-scenes interviews and stuff like that. Plus, the show itself is a show I'm very proud of. It's a perfect Christmas gift for you, if you want to ask Santa to put on his list, or for one of your friends who you think likes me or might like me or might hate me, and you want to see their astonished face when they assume they've got a Mike Flatley DVD and then realise it's even worse, it's one of mine. They'll be disappointed, and then they'll be double disappointed. Also, of course, you can get, if you want, that money will go to me and Chris Evans, not that one, which we will spend on our families. But if you want to help make more Rich Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast, you can also buy my Kickstarter DVD of me interviewing myself. Plus, it's got like over an hour of interviews with the guests from series seven, that were done backstage and never got broadcast to anyone except people who paid for monthly badges. So that's probably worth seeing if you enjoy the show. If you buy that, all that money will go towards series 9 of Rahul Lester Pa. But go to gofasterstripe.com. You can buy either of those DVDs or indeed most of my DVDs and some books. They all make excellent presents. Probably just for yourself to buy yourself, because none of your family will know who I am or know that you like me or are interested in hearing me do hours and hours of comedy that isn't just me talking to other comedians. Just imagine that. I'm quite good. I'm actually quite good. Anyway, let's sit back and enjoy me listening to, I'm not an idiot, I mainly listen to him, Mr. Edward Izzard. Roll the titles.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man. He's still wearing his pyjamas from last week. What's wrong with him? His life is falling apart. It's Richard Herring. Thank you very much. Love to be here. How are you doing? Welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre podcast. This is Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. Some of the cool kids have started calling Rahul Lester. I'll try to get away with it. Got some interesting characters in the front row here. This is an interesting character. How are you doing? What's your name?
Bud.
Bud. Yeah, it's nice. What, they got a sort of Doctor Who scarf? You a fan of Doctor Who?
No, not remote.
Not remote? You're going to be these guys here now. I don't think it's that good anymore. What do you do for a living, bud?
Designer.
You're a designer. What have you, do you design scarves? Because obviously not, because you're getting quite a lot of food. So it's and commercial stuff.
Commercial interiors.
It's a compliment. Commercial interiors. Yeah. Should I talk to you or should I talk to Eddie Izzard? What do you think? I mean, we're in agreement, right? I mean, so, ladies and gentlemen, I think you all know why we're here to see this guy. He's probably best known for his role of Reepy Cheap from the Chronicles of Narnia. We'll mainly talk about that. I'm hoping he's out of the bathroom. Will you please welcome Eddie Izzard, ladies and gentlemen? He isn't out the bath. Yes, he is out the bath. It's Eddie Izzard. Please sit down. Pull up a microphone.
I thought you were going to the loo. I was back there thinking, I think I'd better get near the edge of the stage, otherwise I'm going to be going, where the fuck am I going?
I was a bit concerned you weren't there, but luckily you were.
No, I was gravitating.
So, Reaper Cheap, I'm mainly going to talk for we've got 70 minutes.
I was fired from Reaper Cheap.
I was wondering.
I think there's been about three Reaper Cheap.
Have they?
I loved the Narnia books. My brother was the Lord of the Rings, and I was the Narnia books.
Yeah.
There was a very interesting Christmas. My dad... After my mum died, he would make really wonderful Christmas and write messages from Santa saying, I'm sorry, the Ferrari is not possible, but we can do this, you know, we can do these presents and whatever. No reaction. No, because, you know, I don't think I ever... Did you ever ask? I don't know. Did you ever over ask when you were a kid?
Yeah,
you know,
I really wanted a snooker table. I genuinely did. I went on it. I now have a snooker table.
My mum did this wonderful thing. When we lived near Belfast in Northern Ireland, we'd write it down. She said, write it out. And you write it out on a list, and then you put it into the fire, and it would go up the chimney. And obviously she'd go, all right, I've got all that. But I just thought that was a beautiful thing.
That's nice, yeah.
But I don't remember ever saying, I want a Ferrari. It was just, I want a choo-choo train or this, whatever. But anyway, Dad would get us good stuff. And there was the presents, and there was the stocking thing, the little things that go ping and whatever. And then one year, Dad actually said this on in retrospect, ominous thing. This has no... Well, it does link to Rupert. He said, it's been a tough year this year, so Christmas is going to be a little bit, sort of pared back.
Yeah.
And you're going, pared back? I don't know what this means and stuff. But I was the greedy child, and my brother was this relaxed kind of, I don't know, okay, we got some stuff, it's Christmas, okay, whatever. And we're in bunk beds, and every Christmas used to be, I'm up, it's 6 a.m, God, how does that, whatever that is. And then there was that noise, and after about 20 minutes of me sort of making noises and things and pulling things apart, my brother would gradually get up and look at the things in his stockings.
Right.
And there was... That Christmas when Dad said it was going to be a pared back, my brother remembers this as like a radio play, like a Radio 4 radio play. So he's on the top bunk, and it goes... fruit? Ah, fuck that. And then the light went back off, and I went back to sleep. So I thought, I'm not going to sit around playing with fruit, or even eating it, or pretending to eat it, because you've got to wait until it goes bad. But we did. So I was that, and I remember one year I got the map of Narnia, and he got the map of the Lord of the Rings thing. Because Lord of the Rings,
it's all made up.
Middle Earth, but it's a little bit, here it is, and then there's that, and Rivendell, and it's a bit like, there's a chunk there, and the Riders of Rohan are there, and it's a bit chunky.
Not like Narnia. It's not as good as Narnia.
Narnia's got this weird stuff, and then there's the whole end bit where the last battle, where you've got, there's one, what's that, Susan, the elder sister, and then she's not coming back when they're going up to this amazing place. She's not coming back because she's into boys and makeup, and so they've left her behind, and I was going, what? And then I realised that he was a big religious guy.
Yeah.
And there's all this religious message in Aslan, supposed to be God and all this.
Yeah, my
stuff.
Wife's reread them all recently. She writes children's books and she loved them, and she's quite disappointed in... Because they basically all just die in the last one, don't they? They go to heaven,
no,
basically.
They go to heaven, but I think they check in early.
Right.
I think they check in early to the spa that is. Because I have worked out this as a non-believer in God. Not one God has come down, the Son of God's come, the Daughter of God, the Milkman of God, these other guys come down. But if one God, if there is one, just come down for one day, for fucking 30 minutes, in front of CNN or BBC, not Fox News in America, we won't believe that shit. And don't turn up in a fucking, swamp, because they always turn up, I saw him, I was in the swamp, and he said he was, it's always in a fucking swamp. Why is God, with all this power, just turn up once and just say, or one dead person, come through the clouds and go, it's me, Janine, I died on Tuesday. It's true. It's so be good and you get stuff. Be bad, you go down there. It's a shitter. It's a real horrible. It always smells of poo. And we would click in. Yeah. It would be boom. And then you'd have consultants saying, when's best time to pray? Well, praying in the morning, he's got a lot of stuff on. Best to get up early and do some praying. But then about 2 o'clock, it's just busy, busy, busy. And it's just like Twitter. That's no one's going to pick up on that stuff. And late at night, you may get him on the off chance. These are the way to get prayers through to God. There'll be prayer advisors, but they're not, because it doesn't work. If prayer really worked, everyone would fucking do it.
If he came back,
that's the answer.
If one came down. But if one came down, would that create... Do you think that would create world peace or more problems? Because the people who believed in the other gods would be furious about that they were wrong.
Yeah, but he would hopefully have a little bit of power. So when everyone else said, hey, that's not my religion, I attack you, and he just goes... and they go, oh, maybe it is true. You've got to come down with one or two angels and a bit of shit going on, a bit of a light show. Because if you just come down and say, I am wearing a suit, I'm God, and we go, oh, fuck off. Just fuck off, because if you created all this thing, why didn't you mention that the world is round in the Bible? Why didn't you just say that once? It's a round thing. It's a day and the thing, and the light was invented, and he made a round thing. Anywhere in the Bible, you'd mention the round thing, because it's weird, and the entire fucking universe. Oh, I've got a whole theory of the universe.
Yeah, okay. Let's go. Let's start with that.
Yeah. This is it. It takes about 4 minutes to explain. Okay, so we're here. We've flashed back 500 years, and here, Leicester Square, 500 years ago. I say, you go that way, I'll go this way, and if we go long enough direction, I'll just keep in the straight direction, you keep in the straight direction, and we'll come back and we'll meet here.
Yeah.
Now, 500 years ago, you would have said, if you're religious, you'd said, this is heresy, this is insanity, you're anti-religious, we're going to burn you at the stake. If you were a scientific person, you'd say, well, you can have your theory, but there's no logic to going in that way and coming back that way. Now we know that that was right then, it is right now, it has always been right, because we live in a football.
Yeah.
My theory is we take us up, maybe 2 or 3 people, or we go up into outer space now, so somewhere in between the planets. Then you go off in whatever plane you want to go off in. I'll go off in whatever plane. I think if you go for long enough time, you come back to the same place.
Yeah.
I think that the universe wraps around on itself. It's the only way to explain it. There cannot be a wall in the universe where they say, behind there, there's a squirrel with a gun saying, ooh, don't come in here. Because we've not worked this out. I think if there was a big bang, it went up and it comes back, and then there's a big crunch and there's a big bang and there's a big crunch and there's a big bang. It's like a heartbeat.
Yeah.
And Hubble said that the world is actually, the universe is expanding, but maybe it's going around the back of the universe to come back and smash in again. And maybe it's been going on like a heartbeat forever. It'll never stop. It never starts. No one's arranged it. There's no God. It's up to us. And that's why shitheads sometimes often get in control of things and good people die, because it's that random.
Yeah.
And we're just at they talk about the golden Locke's theory, which is where any closer to the sun we'd burn up, any further away we'd freeze. This is just our time. These are our few billion years here, so let's try and get it right. Good cough. And so that's my theory of the universe. It's as random as it looks. Like, if you put random into the history of the world, it totally makes sense.
Yeah.
You put in someone with a plan. If there's a God with a plan, he's going, pin the tail on the donkey. Who's going to run the world? I don't care. It doesn't make any sense, but random does make sense. And I think, unfortunately, that's it. And after death, I just think it's goodbye.
But that would be... It's better that that's the case, though. That's why I can't understand why anyone would want to live and never... You want to live a bit longer than you're going to get all the time, I think. But to live and never die would be awful.
That would be... That'd be rough.
So you know, even to go to heaven, and it's really brilliant. You go, I've been here for 100,000 years now. I'd quite like to have a sleep. I haven't got any eyelids.
But you could get good sleep. So if you get good, I mean, Highlander, he was doing all right, wasn't he? Christoph Lambert.
Yeah.
He was doing okay. And it's just the head slicey bit that was... But then all the windows blow up, and that was quite funny.
But I think it's definitely, you know, I think if people would see the world as a random thing, whether it is or not, which I think it almost certainly is, that things are very random, then, and that exact thing, accepting we're in control of the world, I think people still have this idea that someone's going to come and save, you know, from in the environment or whatever, going on. There won't be a nuclear war because someone will step in, Superman or Doctor
World
Who.
World War II was a classic example. Surely someone's going to come in and stop that fucker, because if there was a god, he should have flicked Hitler's head off. It was Mrs. Hitler had had two babies before that had died in infancy.
Yeah.
Surely you could make it three, or save the first two and take out the motherfucker, yeah? It's not complicated, God. And if you're not paying attention, why are we bothering? If you're not going to intervene at any point, what's the point of you? You know, so this is my thing. But I believe the major religions all have this one main thing in it, which, in answer to your Reaper Sheep question, which is treat other people as you'd like to be treated yourself. And and they're all, it's the golden rule, it's in all the major religions. And if we do that one, it all works out. And then they say, well, what if you're a masochist? Okay, well, just, they can fuck off. But just, you know, using common sense, apply that logic, and the whole world works. And if you want to pray, if you want to meditate, that's great. That can be very calming. And the churches sometimes are very groovy. You go to Liverpool, they've got a cafe in the church, in the cathedral, which I thought was very groovy. You have a coffee. Yeah, you can buy some books on stuff. But I think Jeezy Creezy was a real guy, and Muhammad was a real guy. And as, you know, and these were real wise people, the right wise men and wise women, in answer to your Reaper Sheep question. And so I think they've been down there through the eons of time, and there will be wise men and wise women in the future. That is the highest level we can attain, by the way, wisdom.
Okay.
If you can get to wisdom, you have made it. That is it. That is the top level.
I'm not sure Jesus would like a coffee shop in his temple. He was quite angry about the moneylenders and stuff.
But that,
maybe the coffee was what made him throw those tables over.
No, I think he would. I think he'd be saying new ideas, because that's what he was. He was a modernizer. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, he came and said, the Jewish religion is there. I want to make an adjustment, because you've got into Caiaphas and all the guys with the big hats had got into big hat stuff and saying it's all about the form, which is like the lost... This is if I'm on drugs, isn't it? I'm just going. No, I'm not on anything. I had a bit of wine.
Some wine, that's all he needs.
The Lost Interview by Steve Jobs, and he talks about that. Has anyone seen The Lost Interview? God, no.
Wow.
Okay, download The Lost Interview. It's Steve Jobs, 10 years after he was dropped by Apple, a year and a half before he came back into Apple. Have a look at it, because he talks about it's the creatives come up with the stuff, and creative people can be really tricky to work with, because they're going, hang on, you've got to... At 2 a.m, that's when the ideas are going to come. But some people get into the form and procedure, and he said IBM were brilliant. Once you've got the thing, you do this. But if the thing is shit, then it's no good. And it's about the ideas. And for modernizing, so I think Jesus, whose real name is Yeshua, Jesus is the Greek version of his name. Would he like to be known as the Greek... Would you like to be known as the Greek version of your name?
It might be all right.
Well, you know, you'd prefer to be known
Someone told
as
me what
you.
That was the other day. It's not far off, Richard, I don't think.
Really? But he was a modernizer, and Muhammad was a modernizer. They modernizers, and Jesus took the existing Jewish form, and he said, we need to update this because it's got into the form of the thing as opposed to the spirit of the message. And he said, let's go back to the message. And it was all peace and love in the 60s. That was what he was doing, wasn't he? If he had a guitar, he would have been, Jesus, I love you, because I'm Jesus, except not Jesus, I'm Yeshua. So he would have done that. He was that kind of guy, wasn't he? He's kind of groovy and out there. And I've seen the musical. It seems very much... And that Muhammad was as well, except they started to attack him, so he attacked back, and so he's seen as a military guy. But he was actually a great fixer. He was a guy who listened. He updated the Jewish and the Christian religions and said, look, here's another way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. So, and then people came along and said, what he really meant was if you draw... The whole drawing a picture thing, I think he was saying... don't draw a picture of me because I don't want to be a god. I am the Prophet Muhammad. I'm not the god Muhammad. Don't draw a picture of me. I've seen this happen with Jesus Yeshua guy. So he said that. And then now he did not say, if you draw a picture of me, murder the person. That is not. That's the reinterpretation by people who wish to control things. And that's what always happens with religions. But if you cut off the mystical top bit of religion, you've just got philosophy. And then you've got ideas which you can take or leave. But it's the mystical top coat. That's the thing that blows us out of the water.
So why did you get replaced as Reaper Chief?
Because he's almost impossible to do. When you read him, you can sort of... You know the story?
I don't remember Reaper Chief. I don't remember
Reaper Chief. He would say things... He had a courtliness. Sir, prithee, sir, but I would take issue with what thou dost say, but we must go in. He was Mad Max crossed with a mouse crossed with someone who's got verbal diarrhea, because he speaks in a way that no human can speak. So courtly, so overly nice and decent in his words, but then he goes in with what must be a needle and murders people left, right and centre. Yeah. So it's a fun idea on paper, but when you get to the reality of it, it's a bit bonkers, yeah, and a bit difficult to land. So I think there was an initial Reaper Chief. I was the second Reaper Chief, then there was a third Reaper Chief. So we went through Reaper Chiefs.
We'll get you all back together at some point. I'll get the three of you to Reaper Chief it out together.
But I did like the Narnia books. And I don't read. That's interesting. I don't really read because of dyslexia. I don't really read novels. But I did like them, and I still do. And I don't think they're about religion, even though they are.
Well, they are, but yeah.
Well, the versions I believed in weren't. No. They're about some bloke and these kids who went through a wall. And
yeah, I mean, it's exciting. This
and
exciting,
the Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yeah, the Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe is a very...
It's fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then the one before them, Magic Ian's Nephew. Yeah. I've got... Well, you see, because I'm dyslexic, I wrote out the story of the magic... And I wrote it on the thing, and I, you know, the magic, and I ran out of space, and I put a dash Ian, and it reads the Magic Ian's Nephew, and I've got.
I would definitely read that.
Absolutely.
So let's move on. There's a lot to talk to you about. I'm going to have to get you back again. I can tell that already. So
you've got a book called Cock.
I've got a book called Talking Cock. You can have that. You'll find out all about cocks. I was looking at your website. I think more possibly than any other comedian. There's lots of things about you. You're a very driven person, but also I think maybe your childhood is... like a big part of that. And not, I mean, I know your mother died when you were very young, but
you would think
that,
but no, because me and my brother are very different. We're 50% the same, 50% different. So I would say, I think it's an inbuilt thing. And my dad's got a similar thing, but I've got this driven like a mouse with a sword, just overly courtly. I had it before and I just couldn't get anything going. In this documentary, Believe, that my ex, she did of me, there's this thing which I'd forgotten about, which I did. I worked out, because I was in a boarding school for 12 years after Mum died, and I worked out, if I put my dressing gown over the back of what were hospital ward type beds, you know, with these big back bits, and if you put my dressing gown over that, and I wrapped it up, and I felt I could pull this the drawstring of the dressing gown, and it went up like a curtain. Right. On the basis of that, I decided to do a show with teddy bears, and I issued tickets, and I got the matron. There was a matron in this, so the matron was coming, and the headmaster comes, and the headmaster was talked about, you know, in the interview about this. He remembered it because it was such a weird thing. And it was very much like my early shows. I had a stage, I had a production, I had tickets, I had no show. And so they're just teddy bears going, I'm going to go over here, I'm going to go over there. Hey, you've stolen my soup. Oh, yeah. Whatever. There was no content to it, which was my early... This is why I didn't get anywhere in my early career, because I would do form over content. Yeah. Just like what Steve Jobs saying in the Lost interview. Download, have a look at it. It's cheap. It's intriguing. But then I realized it's the stuff. Work on the stuff. And if the stuff is good enough, if you build it, they will come. You know, if you make it good enough, they will come. Which isn't a perfect science, but it's a better way of doing it. So that's what I got to at about 25. I dumped my previous technique.
Yeah. So you started in street theatre.
No, I started... I went to Sheffield... Well, I feel I started at 7. I saw a boy with his cart by Christopher Fry in January of 1970, when you were minus...
No, I was 3.
You were 3. When you were 3. I did it specifically because you were 3. And this is in Eastbourne. And I saw this thing. Some kid was on there, and he was pulling focus, and he was doing good stuff. And I think it was dramatic and comedic. And he was. And I just thought, this is fantastic. Maybe it was... I think it was a swap for mum dying, and suddenly the audience would give you all this applause and affection. So I thought, I will have this.
Yeah.
And no. Fate said, no, you won't, because you're shit. Or either I was shit or they thought I was shit. And I think I was probably shit.
But you didn't get in the plays at school.
Couldn't get in the plays. Couldn't get on that. But I was really pushing. I was really doing weird things to get into stuff like Joseph. They did a version of Joseph in his Technicolor Dreamcoat. And I thought, this sounds great. The music sounds great. Only the choir can do it. I'm not in the choir. I'm just going to stand next to them. So I stood next to them. There were rehearsals, and I was just there with a kind of a glassy-eyed look. And then they'd say, we've got to move the table. We've got to put this over there. And I managed to inveigle my way into it, and I got one solo line as well. So this is... Oh, I was always sort of coming from the outside and pushing in, not invited to come play, but thinking, I have to be in this. I broke into Pinewood Studios, you know, when I was 15, and I was just trying to get into things.
Yeah.
I was always this relentless, pushy bastard, but with nothing working. Failed again, and that failure, a whole bunch of failure up front. Went to Sheffield University, did accounting and financial management, realised that wouldn't be... If I got that degree, that would have been beaten over my head, you know. My stepmother was keen to, you've got to get a proper job.
Yeah.
And I just thought, don't get the degree, and then I won't be able to get the proper job. And I have to flame throw my bridges. So I flame throwed my bridges. Flame threw my bridges. And so there was no way back. I had to go forward. And I did three, you know, Edinburgh in 81, Edinburgh in 82, 83, all sketch shows.
Right.
And then 84, took a year off and I came out. 85, street performing. 86, street performing in Edinburgh. 87, street performing in Edinburgh. 88, street performing in Edinburgh. 89, started doing stand-up. 90, 91, 92, and 93. They all stand up. So after those 12, I said, I'm never playing again. But it's just this relentless thing. And once it started working about 1991, then...
I mean, it's so weird, because I think in my mind, I was starting about 89, and you were obviously quite established by then. You were doing... played your club. Well, you were sort of... Yeah, I played your club with Raging Bull.
Raging Bull, yeah.
Which was in the Raymond Review Bar, wasn't it, or somewhere like that? It was a bit later.
Yes, that was 90. That was 90, because 88 I started. I started March of 88.
Right, yes, that was a bit before me. Yeah.
And
all I remember is that the dressing room had strippers in it.
There were actual strippers.
There were strippers changing, going into the other venue, and I'm pretty sure this was...
I think you went to the strippers. Because they shared a bar. It was a very interesting thing. It was Raymond's Review Bar, and then there was the Boulevard Theatre.
Yeah.
We were in the Boulevard Theatre.
That's right, yeah.
But they shared the bar.
That's it.
But if you got in and there were strippers taking their clothes off, you were just sitting there just going... But we did have the audience from the stripper club come into our ones, and they had the same numbers, but different coloured tickets. So they're saying, look, it's B4. It is B4. I said, no, but you... A red ticket, it's a green ticket. And so we had that interesting problem. And the comic strip had been there before, so that's why I chose it. But I just lost a lot of money doing that. But it did get me the ability to stand on stage in the centre of London and have the confidence to go, so, chickens, what's going on there?
Yeah.
And
but very quickly, because my memory is straight away, just nearly all the stand-ups on the circuit were doing you. You know what I mean? It became very... That way of speaking became the kind of way a lot of stand-ups
operated.
That is
an interesting thing. This was said to me, because before it was always, you know, someone's... That joke is yours. And then for me, people very nicely came up to me and said, someone's doing your style. And I don't think it necessarily was my style. I think it was just, if you do go... how soup is if you're trying to improvise in that desperate kind of way, soup, why soup? And you know, if we freeze it, you can kill people with soup, can't you? And if you just play around the soup idea, anyone who was doing that would probably sound like that. Maybe I did it first or before, yeah. And you know, people, so when they did it, they were just doing their own version of it.
Yeah.
There was one person I was told to go and see. And they said, they're doing what you're doing. And I went and looked and I thought, I quite like what they're doing because it's very much like what I do. So I didn't really have a problem with it. David Bowie did a bit of what I was doing. Yeah, I was touring, and they said, David Bowie's doing that bit where you go, yeah, no, I'm not. Yeah, said, David's doing that. And I went, okay, I'm cool. If David wants to do that, that's cool. I think that's quite a... And then I went and saw David Bowie's show, and he says, you know, I'm doing that bit where I go, I'm doing that. So that was kind of bonkers, having played the Guilty P.
Yes.
Do you remember the Guilty P?
I do.
Well, there was a venue called the Guilty P, and why it was called the Guilty... How a P can be guilty... The innocent pee and the guilty pee. Last time I played that, I stormed it, and then it was Kate, I think, who ran it.
Right, see, I think it was
Kate.
Yeah.
And I phoned up Kate, and I think she took a bit of time to get back to me, so it got embarrassing, so she could never get back. And I said, Kate, surely I can... I fucking ripped the roof off last time. And it just got, like, you know, 6 months. Ooh, I think she got into... I can't really call him back, because why haven't I... And so I just never got back to the guilty pee.
Yeah.
Which, if it, on a good night, totally sold out, you'd make 20 quid. 15 quid. But that was the beginning of us. It was an electric... This area was electric. I think it was so many multiple gigs a night.
Yeah.
People just going from nothing, cash in the hand, stuffing it down your shoes and your socks and wherever. It was fun.
Yeah.
It was really fun, and everyone was just going for it.
But then it took off very quickly, I suppose, after that.
For me?
Yeah, for you. Like, you were in Hollywood.
I was military. I'm kind of military with the way I do things, because I wanted to be Special Forces. This was my serious plan. I was going to do paras or Marines and then go Special Forces.
Yeah.
So I was doing off the cadetship. I haven't shown you the photo. No.
I was reading about this, but I'm just trying to imagine how you would have gotten in the paras.
Well,
it would have been a different person.
No, well, I would have been... Well, actually, I don't know if I would have been, I don't know if I would have been, but if I'd gone and seen action, then there would have been... A line would have been crossed. But I feel what I've done is civilian version of Special Forces. Because when I came out 30 years ago, wearing some heels and a bit of lipstick, that was tricky. That was not cool.
No
one thought it groovy. In 85, nor in 90, nor in 95, nor in 2000, nor in 2005. Now it's almost going, hey, there's a thing going on. I'm doing this bit of material when I'm playing in America, which, because they had Caitlyn Jenner, who came out, you know, very famously. Has everyone picked up on this, the Caitlyn Jenner story? And there was also Laverne Cox from Orange is the New Black, a black woman who was born a boy but self-identified as a girl, and she's changed her sex, and she's a strong activist on trans issues. And so I'm doing, when I do gigs there, I say, you know, America's at the forefront of transgender politics, and you didn't choose this? And I have some guy going, and I have some sort of wife saying, honey, you know we're at the... America's at the forefront of transgender politics. I'm just having my breakfast here. What the fuck's going on? No, but we are. We're just totally... I didn't know anything. I'm just sitting here. I'm having grits and fish and helicopters and whatever we eat for breakfast. And men or women and fish and chickens. I don't know what the fuck's going on, but we are at the front. I don't give a shit. Can everyone just put it back in the box? Because it is, America suddenly jumped ahead and they didn't plan it. They just did it. It just happened, and Vanity Fair helped. And
yeah, well, it's amazing how much things have changed. And it does feel that whole aspect just feels like a normal thing. That
yeah, well, it's boring. If LGBT, if we can get to boring, if someone says, I'm gay, you go, yeah. What do you do? Oh, I make soup. Soup. Good soup. Good soup, bad soup. It's the soup thing. Soup could be the new... soup.
I mean, that's it's an amazingly positive thing. Like, because it's weird that it was comparatively recently how anti, you know, even sexuality, but transvestitism.
Yeah,
everything.
I still had it at the pub just next door. Did where I came home but this guy, I live right near a pub, and the guy's out in the street drinking, and as I came in, some guy, hey Eddie, and that bloke go, what the fuck, and the guy, no, he's... Obviously, he said to him, no, he's transgender. He's transgender! But you expect, he's a fucking... You expect to have some big negative epithet coming out of his mouth. He said, he's fucking transgender! What the fuck do I do with that? And then, and I was just... I was knackered. I just wanted to go into the house and relax. And the other bloke would say, hey, all right, hey, come have a drink. And so I thought, no, I'm going to go and have a drink now. If someone's screaming at me and the other guy's backing me up, I'm going to have a drink. So I just said, let me dump this stuff in. I came straight out and the guys just scarpered. They ran to the back of the pub and they hid in the corner. I could see their worldview going,
gears changing. But what are we going to do?
And the other guy just bought me a drink. So, yeah, it has changed a lot, but also it takes about 30 years to get chilled out about it.
Yeah.
From my point of view, because it just used to be tricky. I don't give a shit anymore. But I just toured France, and yeah. They are, you know, there's a lot of groovy stuff in France, and there's not much surreal humour, which is interesting,
right.
Which we think could, because I was touring with a kid called Yassine Bellus, who's already played in English, and he thinks that it could be there's less surreal humour in France because of the Second World War, and there's less surreal humour in Germany as well, and it right. could be Second World War, and in Germany they said, what the fuck do we do? You can't talk about chickens with guns, let's be political, or let's be slapstick or something, but yeah. you can't do that weird shit. And maybe after Vichy France, you know, and Pétain, they said, no, we're not going to do it. They haven't done it. I'm not sure. I haven't checked all the other countries. I haven't checked Spain. And I'll report back on that.
Okay. But this decision to go to France and yeah. not really being able to speak French when you started really particularly well and then do your set in French?
I was okay. I got an A at O level. Okay. A at GCSE.
Yeah. No, I got a B at O level and I can't say anything yeah. in French.
No, interesting. I know people who have degrees in it who will not speak it because everything's about the form, and they can write it pretty good, you know, yeah. and they get all the tenses and stuff, but it's the confidence of talking about it. I've also met one guy who can't write it, but he's very confident and very fluent.
Yeah.
And that's what we get when we're kids, yeah? Because we learn the speaky version first, and then they say, that cat has got a C in it. Not a K? No C. Why C? That's English, kid.
But for you to make this decision to go to... Is it because it's an untapped market who don't know who you as well?
It's a new thing. My ego. I'd like to be big and well-known in France. Yeah. That's one thing. So ego's involved.
But is it also starting... They don't know who you are, so you get to find out if you're... Because it's like when you're successful...
Yeah, it's the beginning.
It's hard to know if you're funny anymore because the audience will laugh at most things.
There is that, but I have found the critics help. I have found the critics help to, you know, say... Yeah. He was shared, and he's just doing the old stuff. And I do find, to an extent, that's true, but to an extent, it's not true. You know, if you are already just chucking out garbage, then your audience will diminish, and you know, it does disappear. But the touring of France was just like the early days in the UK. It was, 100 seaters, 200 seaters. Bonsoir Lyon, bonsoir Lille, Toulouse, qu'est-ce qui se passe? And it was fucking groovy, and I loved it. And then, and I said, also, can we have an Indian summer, please? I just said to the weather fates, because I don't believe in gods, but, you know, I just said, I would like to insist upon this, isn't it? I only finished about a week ago, but it was beautiful weather, and it was just, yeah, it was wonderful. So all of
us. You take on these massive challenges. So I was just watching your program about the marathons where you did, how many did you do? 43 marathons in 51 days.
Yeah.
Now, I've run a marathon and I could not have run another marathon the next day.
You could have if your family was on the line. If it was about your family, yeah?
Well, you know, mate, if I kids, have... Yeah, I've got a kids. Baby, yeah.
Imagine that there was a threat to them and they said, you've got to do this because then you could raise money and there's an illness and you can pay for the thing and you could get that machine that will... You'd fucking run it, wouldn't you?
Well, I would, but...
You'd run 10.
I might run 2.
No, you'd run 10.
And then say, that's pretty impressive.
Goodbye, Mike.
I'd say, that's enough. Sponsor me for that. I've done 2 fucking marathons in 2 days. I am God. So to... You were not a runner, I run a lot, and so, you know, I was running a lot.
I loved football when I was a kid, so I was a fast twitch runner, which is the, you know, the stop, start, stop, which is the healthiest way of doing it. And the long distance running doesn't actually make you that fit, but I did a holistic version of it, where there was an idea that you run fast and then you have a lot of time to relax over to the next thing. Yeah. And I thought, run whatever's fucking speed. Talk to ducks and cats and dogs. I used to stop and talk to sheep and cows and say, I'm running this for sport relief.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And they'd be very cow-like at me and I'd go, if you've got any stuff you can give us, I don't know, hay or... I don't know, it was just fun. I just like, no one was filming it. I was just saying this. And I just thought, this is fun. And I'd stop and look at the ducks and I'd take it in. I ran to past the Battle of Naseby.
Right.
And as you'll know, you know, you're the kind of person who would know about that, you know, Civil War, yeah. English Civil War. And it's a very key battle. And I just thought, my God, this road must have been a track road back in the day. They wouldn't have, you know, the tracks would have been the same ones. So the cavalry, Prince Rupert could have been coming along here, Cromwell, bring the cannon up, you know, this whole thing, and that was right back here. It was the bloodiest time on battles on British soil. And so I would take all that stuff in. That's how I fed it all. Instead of trying to do VO2 max and how quickly, I just ran the fucking thing
it's
and
it still
didn't care.
It's just absolute. I mean, it's I think it's beautiful because you leave London and then you're looking at all the milestones out of London and you're actually, I think that progression, because you never do that. You never walk out of London or run out of London into the countryside. And so to actually take that time, and it's, you're stopping to eat a calippo.
Yeah, calippo.
Or calippo.
Which I said is a cross between calipers and hippos. It's made out of calipers and hippos.
And your trainers are furiously saying, he's got to focus, and you're just wandering up and chatting.
I went to talk to the ducks, and then the guy in charge of ducks said, you can't, this is a royal park, you can't talk to the ducks. Virginia Water. I said, it's for charity, we're just looking at the ducks. He said, okay, you can look at the ducks. So we looked at the ducks. But it's... okay, so first one was okay. Now, the second one, if you do two in 2 days, you suddenly go, God, I could stop now and I could dine out. They talk about this thing of dining out. I don't know how you do this dining out. Will you take me out? I've done two marathons in 2 days. I'd like not to pay and I'd like to dine out, please. Will you do this? Thank you. What's your name? Stephen. Hello, Stephen. I'm going to dine out. I don't know how this works. But anyway, I did think after two in 2 days, I could say, yeah, I did two in two fucking days and... That's it. That's just weird. That's out there. And then I was straight. I couldn't ever punch the sky because I got more and more tired. So the idea of punching the sky. In the end, actually, at the beginning ones, I was just running across and going, that's it. That's 26.2 miles. I go, well, there? Yeah, that's there. It was in Swansea. When I got to Swansea, I just thought, I need some bells and whistles. I need a bloody line. I need some party poppers going off.
Yeah.
And so after that, we set up artificial lines and party poppers. I needed a finish line.
Yeah, yeah.
I needed to have that because I was doing it on a wing and a prayer. So after 10, between 3 and 10, it got really tricky. The feet were shredding.
I just would have expected to be dead by the fourth one.
Well, this was the thing. This is what we were trying to work out. And then I went to South Africa to redo that in 27 days. And I got rhabdomyolysis after 4 because I was on a cholesterol drug and it was not happy with my body. And so the guy said, you just got to stop. You got to get it out of the system. You got to stop for 2 months. I thought, oh, fuck, I've set this whole thing up. So that was a pain in the ass. So I'm going to go back and do that again.
Yeah.
But it's kind of beautiful. After 10, it gets easier.
Okay.
Because this is the trick. After 10, it gets easier. Because you start, the brain starts going, okay, where are we going today? As opposed to, what the fuck are you doing? Where are we going today? And you go, well, let's go, we're going to go over here. And when I would meet kids, I met some kids. I said, "What are you doing?" Because the camera was the big thing—not an idiot running, but a camera. If a camera turned, hey, camera, and then people would turn up and they'd say, "What's the camera?" I'm running around the country. Oh, right, can we come? And then these kids just came running with me, and you know, they were just hanging out. It was in the summer, so probably their holidays, and they just came. They ran for me for about 5 miles. These big, and I said, "Let's sprint the last bit." So they really sprinted, and I was, you could see me miles behind them. They didn't do any of this. Let the old fucker catch him. Let's let him win.
But you did a lot of it, like, on your... I mean, apart from the crew, you're running alone. I thought you'd be running with other people all the way.
No, well, if people wanted to come, I just thought, how can you ask people to come, you know? Yeah. It's. But also, I asked the crew if they could stay back 10 miles or so. So, like, I remember coming back through Northumbria, through the forest up there, and I stopped, and there was a lake, and there was forest... and silence, and occasionally just a single car go by. I thought, this is really beautiful, because normally I'd be in a panic station. I have no car. I'm miles from anywhere. This is the time to panic. But I know I just keep going, and I'll be able to go over there. And I became at one with the road. There's a Native American thing about being at one with the land.
Yeah.
They were born on the land. They didn't own the land. Babies fighting death. Building nomadic, following the buffalo, and everything went back to the land, which I think they laid their bodies out, and then it went back into the land. And it was a big circular religion, and I sort of became one with the road, the street. It became a place. I would pee everywhere, you know, quite... You know, if you've ever had a pee, if you got out of a car and have a pee, you tend to... okay, pee now. But I just got, I'm going to have a pee here. And I would pee, and it was a bit like, I don't know, foxes marking their territory or something. I was marking some big fucking territory. And I just felt this is a road that is mine, in the sense that it's all of ours. It's our road, and we can run along any road we want to. It got really beautiful, and nothing was scary. At one point, I saw the 26 miles that I ran, because in Northern Ireland, I went to Bangor, where I used to live, which is just to the east of Belfast. I ran to Newtownards Hospital, where I'd been in hospital when I was a kid, and I had fond remembrances of the sister who was there, and she made me eat soup, but I wouldn't eat soup again. And I worked out that she said, you've got to eat a bit of it. All right, I'll eat a bit of it. So I picked up the soup, and then I poured it back in the thing, and I realized it made waves, and if you made enough waves, it looked like you'd eaten some soup, because you could create a tidal mark around the edge of the soup. And I said, look. And she said, yeah, okay, that's enough. And I hadn't eaten any soup. So when we got there, we said, can we come in? Because I used to be in here, and we're filming for Sport Relief. And we said, no, you can't come in. And no, it would be great if we could just come in. Just quit. No, there's no way you're coming in here. This is a hospital here, and there's no way. But this is for charity. We're going to raise money. We're going to help a lot of people who are dying of diseases. No. So there was still this wonderful world of no that she had got. It could just be. Anyway, I ran on, and I ran through Belfast, and then there's a hill on the west side of Belfast. It goes up and up and up and up and up. And when I got to the top of that, I looked back, and I could see this little Victorian folly that's just above Newtownards, which was about 20 miles away, 24 miles away or something. And I looked at it, and I thought, that is an insane distance. And that was really, you never get to see. And you know, if you've read it, you never get to see it. You just look back and you can see the last 100 meters, and that's it. But that was fascinating.
It's extraordinary. I mean, it's, I don't know, it's just sort of so extraordinary that you did it. What?
Well, it's fun. It's adventure stuff.
But it's more than that. I can see all that. I would love to do it in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But not actually do it.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I love the idea.
You could play a character in a film who did it.
I would definitely do that. Yeah. Because it'd be nice to be driven somewhere and go.
Now you're doing the last one.
Oh, it's nice around here. Get in the car. But to actually go around the whole country doing it, it's close to being insane, but it's also a beautiful
it's
kind of insanity.
It's the good part of insane.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
It's bonkers. I think bonkers, good bonkers. There's bonkers and good bonkers. There's bad bonkers. Bad bonkers. I'm not sure what bad bonkers is, because Hitler is beyond bad bonkers.
People sponsor you per mile, though, and then you went and said, here, you owe me £1,500.
No, what we did was, because they told us, if you're doing this thing, you've got to do a big upfront. We're doing this thing. Please give. You just got to say, give money. You just got to pummel people into giving money. This is the technique. And I thought, I can't do that upfront, because the idea I'm going to run around the country, I don't know how to do it. I don't know if I can do it. I'll just tweet. So I just tweeted, I'm running around the country. I'm going for a run, I think I said. I might be gone a long time. Anyway, something like that. So set off from Trafalgar Square, And I just thought, I probably got next to no money in until we got to... I thought when I got to Scotland, they would believe it, because they thought, well, if he can run up the top of the map, then he can probably come back down. It's downhill. If you look at the map, it looks like it's downhill. So I thought, they won't believe it until I get to Scotland.
Yeah.
And then after Scotland, it really became, my God, this is going to work, because if you could get up there, if you can do 23, you can probably do another whatever it is, 21.
Amazing. So there's a lot of things to talk to you about. There's your political side of you, which is very interesting as well. And so you're planning to possibly stand for London Mayor in 2020?
Well, I think it'll be more like Member of Parliament.
Yeah.
Sadiq Khan's going for Mayor of London, and he gets in, and then he will logically go for more than one term.
Yeah.
So there's a big fight there, but yeah, I'll go for Member of Parliament. And I don't mind where I'm going in, because I want to know how the whole thing works. It's very, you can see it from outside, you can study it, but until you're really inside it and you see everything going on. I'm a radical moderate. I'm going to take all the energy that I put into whatever I've done so far and put it into that. I do like people. I'm doing well for myself. I want everyone to do well. I do like business. I do like entrepreneurship. I do like a safety net. And I don't see... One thing I do link up with Jeremy Corbyn on is... why, if there was a capitalist financial crisis caused by the subprime market, we all know this. The Tories have spun it many different ways, one way they just blamed it on the Labour Party. But we know it's a capitalist financial crisis caused by the subprime market. They sold these mortgages to people they knew couldn't pay them back. They took their fees up front, so they were all fine and happy. Then the debts blew up, and they were toxic debts, and they packaged them with gold, gilt-edged debts so that it looked like it was all rosy. Then it was all this diseased debt was inside the financial system. It all blew up, and then we have a financial crisis.
Yeah.
Why should the people on the lowest incomes be paying for that? And the rich don't blink an eyelid. They just carry on.
Yeah.
So trying to... Yeah, this is true. But I'm very positive on the European Union, and I'm going to fight like crazy. The stakes, I feel, is if we can't make it work in Europe, then the world is not going to make it. We've got to the end of this century, probably, to get an entire world where everyone has a fair chance. Despair is the fuel of terrorism, and hope is the fuel of civilization. And if we don't get it so the entire world, 7 billion people, all have a fair chance, have the chance of democracy, of a stable government... If we don't get to that, someone's going to invent something so small, the terroristic things. They're putting bombs into liquids, into their bodies. You know, this is... Yeah. Despair will drive that. And the people who are running it, I think they have a twisted logic. They are twisting Islam and the Islamic faith, which I think Muhammad was a decent, honorable person, had some wonderful, positive ideas, and they have twisted that into something else. It's not about Islam. But in doing that, they will just do horrendous things, and there is no limit to it. I mean, if Al Qaeda is saying that IS are out of their minds, then what the hell is going on? So we have to be, if we're not working towards an entire world that's working by the end of this century, or maybe even halfway through this century, because things are moving so fast, we're not going to make it. And so if Europe can't make it work, if we're the UKIP are for running and hiding, I'm not for running and hiding. I don't think Britain is for running and hiding. If we want to change it, we've got to be inside Europe to change it. And so I'm going to fight like crazy for that. And that's what I've been trying to do as I'm touring in French, touring in German, just started in Spanish, then I'm going to do Russian, then I'm going to do Arabic. There is a way of doing things. You have to look at the world as an adventure. You have to look at Europe as an adventure. You have to go for it. And I am, on pure business terms, I am trying to increase... I think I would have broken even. I sold over 5,000 tickets in France in 15 cities. We did 24 shows, double shows in quite a lot of places, to send out a message that an English guy and transgender as well could turn up and do a gig in France. We did two in Lille, two in Lyon, two in Aix-en-Provence, two in Marseille, two in Toulouse, two in Montpellier, and two in Nantes. And played a 1,400-seater in Paris. And this is just not on the map. But it's there if you just have the imagination. And if we go for it, if we head in that direction, it's a positive signal. And the French are now doing it in English. The Germans are doing it in English. Stand-up comedy. The Russians, you'll know this out there. I was on the Comedy Awards, and I made a joke about the Scandinavians are going to come and do comedy. And I think... Jonathan Ross, he made a joke about what I'd said, and he did it just in fun, but he was like, yeah, that's going to happen. And now you know it's happening. Yeah. And these are funny guys, aren't they?
Yeah.
There's some there's great talent out there. Comedy is universal. I've played in Moscow. I've played 28 countries now with this show. I played in Moscow, St. Petersburg. The kids dig it. They really get it. And it's going to become waves and waves, and that's going to be great. And they all want to do it in English because they can tour the world. This kid, Yassine Belous, who's one of the five surreal stand-ups in France, he's played Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Berlin, all in English.
Yeah.
Cape Town, he's played Edinburgh, and that is beautiful. 200 years since the Battle of Waterloo. The English are performing in French, the French are performing in English. That's got to be positive.
It's good, but do you think we... It's good. Let's acknowledge that.
Thank you.
I mean, it seems to me we need so much parliamentary reform in Britain before we get anywhere near that, though. Do you not think it seems to be going backwards with the way that the Conservatives are now in charge with, you know, not even a third of the votes, and changing the boundaries. And so how do we change that? How do we change
I don't know. I don't have magical answers. No one has magical answers. And I think politics is as complicated as it looks. It's really tricky to do. If Jeremy Corbyn can make things change, if he can get the centre of the country to vote for him, then fine, let's go and see what that happens. It's democracy in action. You know, I'm more of a radical centrist, and he's more to the left. But
will that affect your ambitions?
No, because I'm interested in people. I really am bored by the bloody lines. How much time do we spend attacking each other on the bloody lines? I just want everyone to have as decent a time as we can have. I mean, everyone, the whole bloody world. But it's really tricky to do because people say, well, we're here, and those people, who are they? And who are these refugees and Syria? And, well, you know, maybe we caused that way back when we started putting the lines out, when we were doing the imperialistic stuff. It's so complicated. It really is as complicated as it looks. And to try and get a through line, but people elect people because they want a through line, a direction. I've tried it in my own life to have a certain direction. I've been positive on people. I'm positive. I'm doing gigs in different languages so that, and saying to them, I'm sort of grabbing people and encouraging them, go do it. Do it in other languages. Mm-hmm. And some people are going, okay, or some people are doing it anyway. And that's got to be a positive thing. You can't say one magical thing and say, here's a paragraph, and that will answer everything in politics. But I know that I'm quite good at working through things. I try to find the center of an argument, the center of what's working, what isn't working, and I try and go for that. I'll fuck up, I'll make mistakes, but I have energy. I do like people. I like all people except the extremists. They can all fuck off, and be they religious or political. And UKIP are for running and hiding, and I'm not for that. I'm for getting stuck in, and that's the only way we're going to go forward is by learning to live together and work together. That's the only way the future of the world, we have a chance in the world. So that's what I'm going to try and do.
If you can make the sense of humour of politicians a bit better, that'll be good as well. It won't be hard to be the funniest person in the House of Commons, but you definitely will.
Well, the trick, if you're coming from comedy, the trick is not to do... You could put comedy at the end of the line. You have to put forward your point of view, and then you have to do comedy at the end of the paragraph and say, and if you disagree with me, then you're a smelly person. And then everyone will go, wow,
well, there's a lot to talk about and not much time. I've been asked to ask this question by John Gleaves. We'll do this quickly. He paid for this last series and got bumped out. Not for this particular question. How did Aardman approach you to provide the voices of the Easter Island head aliens and melting blob man in Rex the Runt? To change tackle.
How did they approach me? I think they phoned up and asked, and I said yes.
That's
but
good.
I think it was that complicated. But I do love it. I want to do versions of that, because that's how I'd like to use my comedy, because I've tried to, in doing roles like in Hannibal and other dramatic roles I've done, just done Whiskey Galore, which is really, I suppose, a comedy, but I still play that. I love doing dramatic roles, but I'd love to do my comedy in animation.
Yeah, they're amazing, Aardman. They're a Bristol firm, and I'm good friends with one of them. There's someone from Aardman in the audience, actually. So there we go.
Another person from Bristol who's very famous, of course, was Cary Grant.
Yes, he was.
He used to sit in his Rolls Royce eating fish and chips with his mum, who was put in a mental institution by her father. Yeah.
It was called Archie Leach.
Yeah, Archie Leach.
There we go.
It was the name of John Cleese's character in
Fish Called Wanda.
Okay. We're that sad. We can
talking of films. Let's try and talk quickly about some films. I haven't seen this film, but you played Charlie Chaplin in the Cats Meow, which looks really fascinating.
Anyone see Cats Meow?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a beautiful film. Peter Bogdanovich film.
Yeah.
Peter said he's going to do, he does this in his films. He puts on a soundtrack of the era, of the time, but he puts no emotion into it. So he doesn't punch up the emotion or pull back, which is what most soundtracks do.
Yeah.
And he just, it's like a radio being on in the background. And it's wonderfully centering. And Joanna Lumley's in it, and a number of people. It was just interesting because I find Joanna Lumley very interesting because I feel I'm sort of quite like her, then quite totally different. We would argue on God and the monarchy. Those are the two right. things that we disagreed on. But she grew up, you know, there was an India beginning for her, and overseas. And I had a Yemen beginning, and kind of gung ho with things. Anyway, it's a beautiful little story. If you see it, it's all about this thing. And Chaplin was definitely having an affair with Marion Davies, who was Hearst's mistress. Bizarrely, he had an overt mistress. He was that powerful that he could have a mistress yeah. half the year, and his wife was still there being Mrs. Hearst and with the kids, and then he'd have the mistress.
Right.
So she was allowed to carry on and have flings with other actors, but she decided to have a fling with Chaplin, or Chaplin did. And I think what we filmed there could well be true.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a kind of controversial murder story on the boat.
There's a sort of accidental murder. You know, it looks like he was trying to take Chaplin out. And,
right.
And, you know, passion, crime of passion. The French would have said, no, it's no problem. Because they have crème passionnelle, which sounds like cream. That sounds like a dessert. So it's a very interesting little story. And I love it. I've watched it a few times. I think it works.
Yeah. But then you work on big blockbusters like Ocean's 12, Ocean 13.
Well, I love the blockbusters. You know, I would be happy to do blockbusters again, because that's what, you know, action movies. I am an action transvestite. Partly my thing is, if they won't give me action movies to be in, I will just do them myself. I'll actually live the bloody things out. And then whoever does my life is going to have to go and run a load of marathons in some sort of film. But, Valkyrie was fantastic. Filmed it all in Berlin.
Yeah.
Ocean's 12, getting a phone call from Jerry Weintraub and George Clooney saying, when I was in my bedroom in Kensal Green, and say, do you want to come down to Rome for 2 weeks? And they go, okay. But it was a very small role. It was just a cameo role. But they made it cameo, as opposed to, it should have been a bit part role, but it was actually, they made it cameo role. So I was invited to hang out with them.
They've kind of made a rod for their own back in those shows, because they have to add an extra person every time. So by the time it gets to Ocean's 2000, it'll just be mainly introducing all the characters, and then that'll have to be the end.
Well, it was... My one was... apparently, this is what Steven Soderbergh said. This, if you get to a problem in the story, then there is a technique of you add a character in.
Yeah.
And that can introduce a thing.
Yeah.
So that is a curious...
They should have started with Ocean's 1.
I know.
And
well, this is what I thought in America. They'd go, where the hell's Ocean's 1, 2? You know, Ocean's 11. I've missed 10 of these fucking films. But it was fun to do, but I didn't have a big role in it, so that was kind of weird. I felt like I'd got to Everest, but I was going to stay at base camp and wave as they all went up Everest, going, "Good, have fun, take nice photos. I'll be at base camp. I'll sweep up here."
And also with Monty Python, which must be, you've sort of become an extra member of Monty Python, essentially.
I was a stalker fan, really, of Monty Python. I just, I love this stuff. I went to 7 out of 10 of the gigs.
Right.
And that was interesting. I would have gone to 10, but I was touring on the first three. Right. And so I just came back and I just invited friends. I would say, hey, do you want to come? I'm going. And I took the Clipper, Thames Clipper. If you're going to the O2, to get the Thames Clipper, it's nice. You go down there, there's a little bar, you can have a coffee or a beer or something. And then you go all the way down to the O2. And one night, I thought, actually, I'll not invite anyone tonight. I'll just go on my own. So I sat in all the seats of the O2 watching Python. And everyone was watching, even on the most extreme, right at the side. You'd think they'd go, oh, it's a bit weird sort of view angle here.
Yeah.
There's only one couple that weren't watching, and they were necking. And they were... It was like it was a cinema thing, but they were just over the corner. But yeah, it was very interesting. I just wandered around the entire thing, which we never get to do in our gigs.
No.
You never get to sit in the comedy gig and move all the way around.
But it must be incredible. You know, you've worked with them, you've ended up, you know, interviewing them and, referred to as the Lost Python.
Yeah, John called me the Lost Python.
Yeah,
and I checked this, and I went up and said, John, did you really call me the Lost Python? He said, yes, I did. And I thought, and then I forgot to ask him, what did you mean? And I think he meant lost in time. I think yeah. I'm 20 years, almost exactly 20 years out of the loop of it. But when I heard that John was listening to the Goon shows, and he said there were two broadcasts of the Goon shows, and he listened to the second one because he'd missed a joke and he couldn't hear it, so he'd have the radio pushed up to his ear and a cushion around his to hear what the joke was. And I thought, this is, that's how in depth I was on it. And bizarrely, my dad started playing me the Goon shows at the same time as I started hearing about the Python show, so I got the Goons and the Python coming in at the same time, which is odd, but beautiful. And I thought my stand-up, all my stand-up was Python and stand-up. But in fact, it does have this extra element, the narrator. What we develop is the narrator, where we talk to the audience, say, you know, cheese and soup, and you know, and then we put forth it, and then you can do a whole scene with cheese saying, I'm cheese, how are you? Oh, I'm soup. Oh, I'm a bit ill today. Well, you look a bit milky. And then all the scenes are actually just me doing Python, totally influenced by Python. But all the narration is something I found from the street. The street really made me. The street is the key. It's so hard to do the street. It's just no one wants to watch you.
No.
I remember setting up, I bought these tea cozies, different animal tea cozies, and I used to, you need to get an audience. So you'd spend a lot of time just fucking around trying to do stuff that looks kind of interesting. So I'd take about 10 minutes to put out a penguin tea cozy. And on the ground, I just put it on the ground and I put it with a lot of focus. And everyone think, what's he going to do with the penguin tea cozy? And I wouldn't do anything with it. But I remember doing this one day and it was kind of windy and it was Covent Garden and it was not good. And people were kicking over my props. So just walking through my show. And I started this technique, which I love, which was I started singing, there's no business like show business. And I would just sing that in an ironical way as I was setting up this for this obviously terrible show that's going to make me 10 quid. But, it really did make me, because in the end, the confidence comes out of your stomach.
Yeah.
You just burn from your stomach. In the end, I started talking to invisible audiences. I would stand in front of no one and go, good evening, it's great to be here. It's very funny. Okay, I'm going to go. And I'm like, nice to see you here again today. And we're going to do a show tonight. And I just talk to no one. And I could talk and talk and because I could keep going. I realized I could like the circular breath of the trumpet players and jazz. And until someone comes, we got some visible people here today. And I developed this technique of imposing scenarios. People would walk by, like to an old couple, and I'd say, that's Janine and Steve. They are actors. They're paid by me to walk around as an old couple. Ginny, Stevie, how you doing, mate? You see, they ignore me. They are in character. They will not break out. But if they look round, they go, hey, hey, hey. No, but they look with a fixed stare, don't they? They stay in character even though they recognize me. There's fiver in the post, mate. And they will be back in 5 minutes and they will be dressed totally differently. And then I picked two other people. And then I couldn't even remember. Was it Roger? Kenny? Your names, you keep moving your names. It didn't matter. They knew it was bullshit.
Yeah.
But the imposing scenarios, that was a beautiful idea. I did love that idea. There was one... up at the Edinburgh Festival, right? They have a parade. I don't know if they still have the parade, but they had a parade. And they had invited dignitaries, somebody dressed as, you know, there's generals and a thing, and the uniforms and dressed up, big coat, big frocks and all that kind of stuff. And they were at the front. At the back were a load of limos set up, and all street performers waiting for this parade to stop so we could start performing. And I just realized I've got a situation. And I said, okay, ladies and gentlemen, there's some friends of mine. I've got them to dress up. One is an army general, and they've got them wearing costumes and big frocks and stuff. And they're going to be coming through here, getting into the limos that I've arranged here. And they're all friends of mine. It's Kenny. He's dressed up as a general. It's Roger. He's dressed up as a lady. And they're going to be coming out. And I just knew, as they come out, I go, Roger, Steve, Kenny, Janine, you're looking great. Excellent. Get in the car, for fuck's sake. And I knew they couldn't fuck with it because they would all go like this. Look at that attention to detail there. This is in character. Stanislavski, eat your fucking heart out. Get in there. It was... in the end, the limo drivers realized this is going to get bad. They drove the limos around the corner because they just realized I was gonna have such a beautiful situation. It was street performing in the end, playing with that, playing with people who didn't want to watch you in the first place. That That's why I've played Hollywood Bowl, because of that. Because I don't think people... Other stand-ups don't play Hollywood Bowl because they think it was outdoors.
And yeah.
The birds and things.
But it's also... I mean, it's that length of time that you're working. I think, like, people don't necessarily... I don't think I necessarily appreciated that it was that long that you were working
at
it.
4.5 years, yeah.
And then that the drive and, you know, it's sort of incredible. You need to be that... dedicated.
Yeah.
It's not even being ambitious. It's just, I love this job so much that I will do it wherever I can do it.
If you can do stuff you really like. Some people do stuff, you know, I remember meeting people on the circuit and their show was tired. And they go, well, I said, why don't you do new stuff? And they go, well, I don't know how to do new stuff. Or, all I wanted to be was on the circuit. I don't know what to do now.
Yeah.
You know, they got tired with it. But if you're constantly coming up with new stuff, that made it interesting and
And do you think doing these impossible things is partly you're pushing yourself to do something that's sort of impossible? Because on paper, doing a show in Arabic when you can't speak Arabic or running around the whole of the United Kingdom is impossible, and then you've decided to do it and you can do it.
No, it's more like this is more, you know, special forces stuff to do stuff this way. It's not impossible. It's just improbable. Mission improbable. It's not on the list. What I do love being off the list. You see, if you do the gossip column thing, you know, if people do the gossip, yeah, they're telling you, hey, they're there, and you're on Strictly Come Elephant and whatever, you know, if you're doing those things, then you can get a, and yeah, we know you're on Strictly Come Elephant. And if you're not doing that, you better pull some your liver out of your lungs. You've got to do something weird. So I decided I'm going to do stuff that no one really gives a shit about. Like, look, touring France and French. I think it's amazing. I'm going to tell everyone, cats and dogs and everyone, endlessly about this. I've become a really boring twerp on it. But no one really gives a monkey. It's not like, just back from France. He's done it. It's not happening. No front cover of anything. It's just, but I think it's beautiful. So that's what I do. And I do those because they make me feel good.
Yeah.
Means that if I go around like this and someone gives me grief, I will go into them. I will walk into them and say, is there a problem? Like the kids in Antibes, right down in the south of France, who decided to get arsey with me.
Yeah.
So I was walking out the door of, it's just a station, there's a little cafe at the station, and I was walking out and I heard them go, hang on, I'm going back in. And I said, il y a un problème, il y a un problème ici? Yeah, it's way cool. And the boy, young teenage boys, they were giving me shit. They're going, you know, you want to fuck men? They said, what's going on here? You know, they're just being very negative. I said, be cool, soyez cool, man. Soyez cool. C'est le troisième millénaire. Soyez cool. And I just stood in front of them and I wouldn't move. I do this thing of when people get into sniggering and giggling, I go and stand next to them. And I get my phone out and I just look at things. And I did this. There was a restaurant. I was touring in America. And these teenage boys, these were. And so we're going into a restaurant. And we're going in, and one of the guys opens the door, and as it goes in, I can hear this thing. What the fuck is that? They go in, and so they've all got into this huddle and the giggle thing. So I think, fuck it, I'm going back out. So I go back out as if I'm going to make a phone call or text or something, and I stand right next to them. So if they're there, I stand there, and I do this, and then the giggling and they can't do it because it's too close. So then they move over to the side, and I just wander over and do it there. And then I could see them, like, mentally blowing up, and then they started leaving. They started leaving, and they were going, they'd all come out to eat. And then there was one guy who obviously was the least bothered about this. He says, are we eating or what? Because they had gone home. It's an amazing, it's a wonderful little thing. You just stand next to the people who are giving you grief. Now, the kids in Antibes, they were giving more overt grief, and so I had to front them all out. And there was one girl who was positive, and the rest were kind of negative, but I will front that out. And then the kid, Yassine kid, Balouch, he's known in France, and he's up and coming there. So, and he's from Algeria as well, so he's very cool. And as I was leaving, and I felt I'd done my bit, and we'd had a bit of an argument, and fuck it, whatever. And then they go, hey, it says Yassine. And they're all running up saying, hey, Yassine, you're on the telly. I thought, I know Yassine. So I came and stood there. Yeah, I know him. So, and then Yassine's going, is this cool? Have you got a problem with this? And they go, you, but, and why? And he says, no, he's a very good comedian. And it's all in French. All this is happening in French. And then he says, if you're cool. So Yassine said, if we're cool, we'll do a selfie. And then the girls stayed and the boys all ran. If you go back in my timeline, you'll see this. There's three girls there. And in the background, there are these boys just trying to... One guy with a backpack. I'm getting out of here. I can't be standing next to a guy with lipstick on. But that's my special forces thing. So these things are not impossible things. They're partly to get publicity for... You know, we want to people to buy and come and know it. And we obviously, if we value our stuff, we think our stuff might be better than some mainstream saying, hey, some mainstream doodah stuff. You know, we're trying to do some really interesting stuff here. Yeah. So that's what it's all about, is trying to crack through. And if I can't get publicity headlines on it, because you've got to be doing gossip column and all that kind of stuff, then I'll get grassroots level stuff. That's what I'm doing. So people go, well, fair play. Fair play, you know. I didn't know about this, but now I know. Fucking hell, you know. Yeah. And I'll come along and I'll check it out. You know, that's, you can get straight through. And with social media, we can do this. Yeah. We can just circumnavigate the thing. That's why you're doing the podcast. You know.
Yeah.
We just cut straight through.
Well, I mean, are you claiming who you are? I think, isn't it? This is what your life is. You're sort of this is who I am.
Yeah, and this is what anyone can be. And I encourage anyone to, if you can make life into an adventure, because life can be really tricky. There's an analogy of a river. If life is a river, if you see these canoeists when they do the speed stuff, they really canoe fast to get yourself and navigate the direction you want. You've got to paddle like crazy. And that's what it is. That's what life is. To really actually navigate through life, you've got to be putting some effort in. If you just float along, it could dash you against the rocks. You could have a beautiful life, but you could just end up smashed against the rocks. And I don't like those rocks.
Well, we've got to end it, so that seems like a good place to end it. So we give a massive round of applause to Eddie Izzard, ladies and gentlemen. Eddie Izzard, thank you. You have been listening to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Eddie Izzard. What? How do we get him? The music is by Pess. Thank you to everyone at Leicester Square Theatre. Thank you to everyone from Go Faster Stripe who make all of this possible. Thank you very much to my producer, Dave Cribb. He does an excellent job. This is a Sky Potato, Go Faster Stripe and Fuzz production for the internet. Hope you enjoyed the show. Do come and see me on tour if you like me. Maybe just like the guests, and that's fine. So don't come and see me on tour. My show's called Happy Now, and it will be all over the country. Go to richardherring.com and you can find out all the dates for that. It's selling well already, so do book ahead if you want to come. Thanks, a lovely way to support me. Thank you. If you want to support the podcast, go to gofasterstripe.com/badges. Buy a one-off badge or buy a monthly badge, and you get some lots of extras and a secret channel and all sorts of stuff. You'll be able to see me interviewing Eddie Izzard backstage if you get... pay £1 a month, amongst many other things. So thank you for listening. Do spread the word about the podcast. Tell all your friends if you have enjoyed it. And why wouldn't you have enjoyed it today? I don't know. Because you're an idiot? Yeah, that's the only reason. Thanks for listening. If you didn't enjoy it and you got this far, you really are an idiot. So you deserve everything you've got there. Goodbye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.